Well, beloved listeners, it is well known to you that the indigenous people of this country managed to look after things pretty well for 60,000 years or so, working with the land's strengths and weaknesses to supply themselves with food and shelter. But when the white fella arrived in 1788, they brought with them the farming methods of Europe, which they've continued to struggle with, and sometimes with success, but just as often with failure. Those hard-hoofed animals on the thin crust of Australian soil. Our next guest believes that we are at a tipping point. As he describes it, he's part of an underground agricultural insurgency, and the goal of the insurgents is to get farmers to change the way they work the land. And as he knows, our farm is a part of that movement. Despite the failings of the current prevailing farming methods, he's still hopeful that the health of the land and the people who live and depend on it can be turned around. Lo and behold, here with Charles Massey. Charles is a fifth-generation farmer from the Monaro region of New South Wales, and he's written a fascinating book about the land we live in, The Call of the Reed Warbler, published by the University of Queensland Press. Welcome back to our little wireless program, Charles.
Great to be with you, Philip, again.
The title, if you please.
Yes, well, look, the book came out of me going back to Australian National University at the ripe old age of late 50s and doing a PhD to ask the question, why did some of these new farmers change? And along the way, I learnt in looking at mind transformation how powerful metaphors are in the way we think, something that I know in your writing you're familiar with. And so one of the stories I was chasing was a farmer just out of Canberra who'd followed some of Peter Andrews' work and regenerated his creek. And we went out for a drive, and the neighbour was flogging the hell out of his country, which was bare and no water anywhere. But when we got to the neighbour's work, he was this running creek with green grass either side. And while we were chatting, there's a little patch of reeds the water birds had brought in. And in the middle of our conversation, this beautiful reed warbler called out of the reeds. And it was probably the first time in 140 years that that sound had occurred again in that valley after it was denuded. And I thought it was just a wonderful metaphor for this process of renewal and regeneration of our landscapes.
It's a lovely sound. Okay, you say that we're now in the era of the Anthropocene. First explain to the listener what that means. We did a program on it a while ago, but we would be well to remember it.
We certainly would. Philip, because it's probably one of the most important and serious issues humanity's ever confronted. I'm still attached to the ANU, and down the corridor from where I occasionally work is some of the world's leading scientists, not just in climate, but in physics and chemistry and biodiversity. From what I've read and heard and talked to a range of scientists, there's an overwhelming consensus, you know, 95% plus, despite what our sceptical politicians are saying, that what we've done to the Earth and its 8 or 9 interrelated major systems is tipped our planet and its systems into an incredibly dangerous new era. And because it's man-made through what we've done to those systems, hence Anthropocene. And so we only hear a lot about climate disruption, but we're now in the sixth greatest extinction event Earth's ever seen, this time human-caused, you know, 1,000 times rates of extinction events in the last 200 years. We're destabilizing land systems and our water cycle and our nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. And, you know, I can go on, but all this is human-caused, and industrial agriculture plays a big role in it. And so conversely, I'm saying that a regenerative agriculture can help undo that. And so the book's really a story of hope and lots of stories about what's going on.
We'll march in that direction, but I want to take a step back. We talked earlier, or I did, about the Indigenous Australians and 70,000 years of habitation. Do we perhaps sentimentalise or romanticise Indigenous maintenance of the landscape? Did they always get it right?
Look, it's a really good question. We've got to be careful of the noble savage idealism. You know, I mean, they're humans. They would have made mistakes for sure. And that's, if you're like a farmer like me, you learn from your mistakes. But I think what Bill Gammage and Bruce Pascoe and that have shown is that, and I work with an Indigenous elder at home, a senior lawman, and I'm in awe of the skills he's got in cool patch burning to regenerate a landscape. So the skill level in what Bill Gammage was talking about, the fire management of our landscape, is quite extraordinary. You know, I was a fire captain for many fires, and I feel like I'm in kindergarten working with this guy. But
there's a very generous tribute to you by Bill, along with one from Ian Lowe and someone called Patrice Newell. Oh, yes, that's my missus, isn't it? Okay, you set off to meet many farmers who've been adopting regenerative farming practice. Now, how does regenerative farming differ from organic or sustainable farming?
Yes, again, a really good question. Having gone to the Australian National University, the Fenner School of Environment and Society, I got bludgeoned with the word sustainable, and I've come not to like it. To me, it just means marking time, holding firm. Whereas the concept regenerative farming means working with ecological systems to really re-empower them to renew, improve soil biology, biodiversity, those sorts of things. And so there's a range of practices, not just things that you and Patrice might be familiar with, holistic ecological grazing, for example, which is now 30 million hectares worldwide, many continents. There's forms of renewing soil biology, which you're familiar with, biodynamics, but also what's called biological agriculture. There's new forms of farmer-driven regenerative forestry called agroforestry, and new types of water harvesting, whether it's old P.A. Yeoman's Keyline or Peter Andrews stuff. So,
and of course, you'd also have to factor in permaculture.
Absolutely right. Yes, that's another key one. That's a design approach that's applied. So those are all elements of regenerative agriculture, of which organics is one, which is sort of now got a name for certifying product that's grown a certain way.
I'm talking to Charles Massey, who was last on the program when we were discussing breaking the sheep's back. Heavens above, that was back in 2011. Now, you explained the five landscape functions through stories from farmers. The first one is the solar energy cycle. Tell us what you learned from farmer Tim Wright in the New England.
Yes. Just to preface that, as a farmer going back to university and sitting through soil science again, I heard the same I'd heard 40 years ago, which is a lot of physics and chemistry, but nothing about exciting biology and sort of more complex ecological function. And my eyes began to glaze over, and I was probably more tertiary educated than some farmers. So I thought, you know, there has to be a better way. And so I've adapted five key landscape functions so that it easily graspable for anyone, and obviously the prime one is solar. It's all our energy comes from the sun via, if you like, solar panels on plants, which make sugars, which then drives the healthy soil biology, and away we go. And one of the exciting practices in regenerative agriculture is a new ecological grazing approach that's come out of Zimbabwe, where a guy called Alan Savory,
who we've had on the program, great
yes,
fella.
Yeah. He is, and huge impact. And that's his practices that are now being widely adopted, and I practice them myself. And
well, so let's talk about some of them. Decreased paddock sizes, of course, which gives every paddock longer to recover, and shorter grazing time so you don't overstress them.
Yes, well, that's about what you've just asked, the solar thing. So the idea really, in a basic nutshell, is our role as landscape managers is to put as many solar panels on our plants and keep them green for as long as possible. And Savory noticed how these mass migratory herds in Africa, you know, millions, Rather than destroying the soil with the so-called hard hooves, were actually regenerated. It was the healthiest grasslands he'd seen, and he asked what the hell was going on. And it was really a lot of dung and urine and disturbance, but which encouraged the soil, and then the valuable plant species are given a lot of rest. So his task, and he was involved in the military, one of the founders of the famous Sulu Scouts in Zimbabwean Civil War, his task was to somehow mimic those animal herds, but in a human management system. And the way is to increase the mob size and move them quickly and give your paddocks more rest. It's in a crude example. And through that, you then get extraordinary regeneration. And in Tim Wright's case, in a bit over 20 years, he's effectively tripled the number of sheep he can carry, and everything's far more healthy, diverse and resilient.
And he's not dumping fertiliser.
Well, that's the other big spin-off. That's right. He's immediately slashed costs with no fertiliser and chemical. And in fact, recent soil tests, aside from his extraordinary increase in biodiversity in his landscape, shows that the key elements like phosphorus, et cetera, are at higher levels and more available. And that's because the biology is active and his roots are going deeper in the soil, et cetera.
My guest is Charles Massing. The book is Call of the Reed Warbler, and this is LNL on RN. Okay, that's the solar cycle. The water cycle, restoring the water cycle. How the hell can you do that?
Well, once you get the solar cycle working, all these cycles are interrelated, of course. You pull the rug out on one of them and the others are affected. And once you start getting your plants going deeper with a greater variety of perennials and variety of different roots and forbs and that sort of thing, and your soil becomes healthy through the extra plant sugars, and you're not killing off the biota with poisons or fertilizer, you get much greater absorption of water. And we now know that from plenty of research that if we just increase 1% more carbon in the soil, which the soil bugs do for you by producing a magic carbon thing called glomalin, you can store an extra over 140,000 extra litres per hectare. So it's sort of no-brainer stuff, but you've got to get all those things working in a regenerative fashion and fixing carbon and punching holes in the soil and those sorts of things.
And that of course, makes revegetation doable, plausible, doesn't it? Because in the past, you observed that many farmers only had 1% or 2% of their land in its natural state. But when they increase that to, say, 20%, there's a significant improvement in productivity.
That's right. That's one of the other functions of sort of dynamic ecosystems or biodiversity. A third function is obviously your soil mineral cycle. But yes, I studied a number of farmers, many of whom had their original vegetation had got down to 1-2%, and they've rebuilt it to 20-odd%. And you'd think, we've taken out 18-20% of valuable land. We're going to have a decrease in production. But conversely, what's happened is that they've got extra shelter, they've got more pest control, they've got better lambings, the stock are doing better, there's more resilience in the landscape, there's more water capture, and they're growing more feed.
Need for those expensive outside inputs.
Absolutely right. So, yes, they're weaning themselves off the drugs at the big end of town. Let's not forget who's driving this. It's some of the world's mega companies who are only interested in profit. And so they're weaning themselves off that. And
That's a good way of putting it, because we are, in fact, or much farming is drug addicted.
It is. It's a very good analogy. We become dependent on it. Because, let's face it, a lot of our extension and teaching is has been about you've got to put these things on to grow food. But new understandings of ecology. And I guess one of the really exciting ideas when I went back to university and had 30 years catch up to do, what had emerged in the last 20 years out of things like systems thinking and computers and way out physical physics research like chaos theory, is this idea that if enabled, natural systems have a capacity to self-organise themselves back to a state of resilience or health once they've been disturbed, whether it's drought or whatever disturbance. And it's one of the big ideas, in my view, of the last 20 years. And I kept hearing these farmers saying, look, my job is to get out of the way of Mother Nature and let her get on with it. And I thought about that, and I realised intuitively they were saying, let self-organisation processes occur by enabling it and us stopping to the interference.
And one of the blokes, one of the people, that's D6 the term, that's helped is Colin Sells, is it, from Gulgong?
Colin Sice, yes. Now, this is a really exciting development. Colin and a few other farmers. There's a wonderful ecological thinker in America called Wes Jackson, who's been trying, along with Russians and Chinese and some Australians, to breed a perennial grain out of perennial grass, because our grain crops tend to be annual plants whose role in life is to produce a lot of seed. That's their survival strategy. And so we've selected wheats, cereals, those sorts of things to do that. But Wes Jackson's been trying, as have other scientists, for a long while, to have perennials do it year on, year on, with deeper roots and all that. But it's slow progress. And then a few Aussie farmers, two in particular, Colin Sice and a guy called Bruce Maynard, sort of thought laterally, and it came out of, you know, you don't get innovations out of the soft, rich soils. It comes out of tough environments. It's often, as you would know, what prompts lateral thinking out of desperation almost. And Colin, his story was he was burnt out in the bushfire, lost everything. And so he had to start farming with no cash, nothing. And he said, well, look, we've got these native grasses, what are called carbon four grasses, that go dormant in the winter and are summer active. What happens if we drill in without using any fertilizer and et cetera, drill in the autumn when these grasses are going to sleep? We drill in our cereal crops or canolas, which are now all edible for animals. Then we graze them with animals on that savoury system, so that makes more dung and recycling. And so you're
actually blending weeds and crops.
Well, you're blending a grassland. You're growing crops in natural grassland, which when they start to wake up in the summer, you're just harvesting, and you end up with sort of more year-round green feed. So, and there's a synergy between the animals grazing and recycling dung and stooling the plants and using these native grasslands. And Bruce Maynard, who's evolved a slightly different system with different technology, he's now got a marketing approach that he calls grassland grain. So it's, you know, the converse, Philip, is to grow a crop, you plough the hell out of country originally, and now you spray the hell out of it, and you end up with a lot of bare ground in between that.
And compressed soils and all the problems that come along with those.
All those
farming
things.
Techniques, yeah.
Yes, and your soil's being exposed to hot weather, it kills the soil bugs, and you have less of that and so on. And so the food isn't getting the nutrients it should because the bugs aren't working. So it's an exciting development. The yields may not be up there in a good season, but when you get your tough seasons, these approaches are far more resilient, and you don't get your crashes that industrial systems can get.
Let's go back to the drug addictions we were talking about. One of the drugs that particularly concerns you is glyphosate. Tell us about that.
Look, most people would know glyphosate under the brand name Roundup, developed by Monsanto in the 60s and then made commercial in the 70s, and today it's now off patent, so other companies are using it. It is now the world's largest used herbicide, over a billion tons. It's an $8 or $10 billion industry today. And a lot of modern cropping right across corn, soy, all the genetically modified crops are genetically modified so that they put in genes so you can spray the crops with this Roundup with glyphosate without killing the plants. But all our modern cropping in Australia, cereals, etc. The positive that glyphosate allowed was you didn't have to plough the soil to control the weeds. You could do it with a one-off or two-off spray. But now, in the last 10 years or so, evidence is emerging, and I personally think this is going to be bigger than tobacco. Evidence is emerging that glyphosate is getting into our food, being uptaken by plant roots and soil bugs, etc. And recently, there's a whole plethora of papers now emerging, but recently a couple of researchers in the States, very brave, because previously if you tried to research glyphosate, you'd lose tenure because of the power of the big chemical companies on the universities. But they've now surveyed upwards of 300 medical biomedical papers. And in a nutshell, glyphosate is completely blowing apart the immune function of our gut flora, which is really our main interface with our environment and the key part of our whole immune system. And it's destabilizing amino acid cycles in there. And their conclusion in what's a world-shaking paper, and there's a lot more coming now, is that it's probably the major disturbing factor in all the modern health diseases that we're now experiencing. And if you have a look at what's happening with across the spectrum, whether it's the allergies and the autisms and all those sorts of things, right through to cancer and obesity and things, there's an extraordinary correlation between the arrival of glyphosate in big volume in the late 80s and 90s and the takeoff of these modern diseases. So the evidence is still piling up. Heaven forbid, the other day in Germany during the Munich Beer Fest, they tested the main 12 beer hop varieties in Germany, and all of them were contaminated with glyphosate, which obviously upset the Germans. But the point is, I think this is the tip of the iceberg, and it could be bigger than tobacco in many similar respects.
As you and I well know, very often the first farmer or farmers in a district who starts to try regenerative techniques is regarded as a ratbag or a communist or worse. Let's imagine you've got a room full of farmers in front of you. They're not an easy audience to persuade, are they?
No, and there's sort of a healthy component to that, because too often we've had shysters or unthought through research foisted on us, and we farmers are an independent lot, so that's the healthy side. But quite often there's a lot of peer pressure, and we're all familiar with the power of paradigms and worldviews, and to have something quite radical to shift decades of family and other practice is a big challenge. And Alan Savory, who we've mentioned, he has spent his lifetime, his worst opponents aren't farmers, they're entrenched scientists who are sticking to their paradigm, who fight viciously. And he calls it the 100-mile barrier. It's very hard for anyone in an innovating farmer's own district to adopt, because in effect, the farmers that follow, the secondary adopters, have to admit, well, I've been wrong most of my life. And that's hard on the ego. And it's easier for a farmer from another district to come in, pinch an idea, and be seen as an innovator.
Well, one of the symptoms of what you're talking about, one notices, is that although farmers generally acknowledge that things are going from bad to worse, they also tend to be rather sceptical about climate change. Yet the techniques you're talking about are also very good for carbon retention.
Exactly right. And there's a lot of good reasons to get ground cover up with the increasing temperatures coming. But yes, the Wentworth Committee, for example, made the statement, and I've seen it corroborated, that if in just 15% of our landscapes, we could add another 1% of carbon, which isn't a huge amount to do if you use healthy regenerative techniques using soil biology. But so just 15% of our landscape, an extra 1% of carbon, would pull all the extra carbon out of the atmosphere that we've pumped up since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So that's why I'm really strong that, industrial agriculture's practices might have contributed to some of the Anthropocene systems problems, but gee, it offers big pathways of hope.
Now, Gladys and Potties, what can you do to help? Well, you can buy from farmers' markets. You can perhaps not go so often to the big supermarket chains. What else do you reckon they can do to help, Charles?
Well, look, that's a really good question, Philip, because this is a two-way partnership. We know that the big industrial food processing companies, the way food is distributed and marketed by the retailers, it all serves to prostitute food and the way we grow it with chemicals, so that the food that ends up on many tables is bereft of most of the key nutrients that we co-evolved over, you know, a million years to for our own health and our immune systems and our functioning. And so put it crudely, you start eating certain hamburgers with a MC prefix, you're eating food that's effectively nutrient empty, bereft of a huge variety of chemicals for all those food processing reasons. And that leads to things like obesity and the other diseases. So the best thing that our partners in the food chain can do is start educating themselves on what truly healthy food off healthy, biologically alive landscapes, just how different it is and its implications for human health. And I've got my youngest daughter working in the Melbourne food area, and there's a wonderful revolution already going on with food gardens and Stephanie Alexander's education programs and community gardens, et cetera. And so we need that demand pull factor from the other end, but it's a two-way partnership to have this underground insurgency, this bottom-up revolution that I'm talking about.
Charles Massey, farmer and author of The Call of the Reed Warbler, published by University of Queensland Press. And oh, I can hear the call of the koala. Charles, you've just got yourself a koala stamp.
I've been waiting for that all my life. Thank you.
Good on you. Now, coming up tomorrow, what's really happening in the Philippines? Thanks, Charles.